Hi, I'm Ernie Hudson, and you're listening to the McSauce Podcast.
Welcome to episode 337 of the McSauce Podcast. My name is Paul McGinty. With me, as always, are Ian the Sauce Sharpley.
Hello.
And Matt Cassell.
Hello.
It is Monday night, August 31st. And tonight, as we close out sort of the summer season with Labor Day right around the corner, we are talking about the Todd McFarlane documentary that was on the Sci-Fi Channel. I'm sure it's...
What was it called? Like Hell I Won't.
Like Hell I Won't, the Todd McFarlane documentary. I'm sure it's available on Sci-Fi's.
Or maybe it's
website.
Like Hell you I
can
Will.
You can just stream it on YouTube right now if you wanted. So, Like Hell I Won't is you're correct.
It's not long. It's
it
only
leans into his stubborn nature and also his love of demons and hell.
It's only like 45 minutes. It's pretty quick. Mm-hmm. Like you can blaze through it. So good listeners, if you have time, blaze through it and then come back, listen to the rest of this podcast. It'll give you a little bit of reference for all of the 90s comic book madness Matt and Ian are going to dip into tonight and drag me along in their wake.
Drag you to hell.
And back.
But before we get into... T-Mac F, we do housekeeping with Ian Sharpley.
Go to McSauce.com. There would be no McSauce.com if it wasn't for Todd McFarlane. Todd McFarlane, the inspiration for my comic love, Matt's comic love, and if I didn't like comics, then stupid Paul wouldn't have been convinced to like comics. So you can thank Todd McFarlane.
Go ahead,
for all
thank him.
Thank who? Thank Ian?
Yeah, you can do that too. Check out McSauce.com. Check us out on all the social medias. We also have a Patreon. We've been slacking a little bit. I know that we formerly were giving you a double dip of McSauce. We kind of got off of that a little bit, but in the new month in September, when all the kiddies are going back to school, we also will be going to McSauce University, and we'll give you some more episodes of the Patreon. Exclusive listener content that you have signed up for and that you're looking for. So $5 a month gets you the archive of exclusive episodes. We have over 20 episodes right now. There are things that we normally don't do on the main feed. We have some music episodes. We have some one-off episodes where we will just have one or two of the McSauce crew members manning the ship. So give us a listen, check us out, and if you sign up now and you're a new subscriber, your $5 gets you a specialized, personalized episode. You can go on, you will be sent a survey, and you can fill out exactly what you want us to talk about, who you want to be on the show, and most importantly, how hammered you want us to be. So go to Patreon, type in MCSOSS, and sign up today.
So, probably, you know, a few weeks ago, Sci-Fi premiered the Hell I Won't, the Todd McFarlane documentary, and I think you guys had watched it, and I was like, yeah, I'll check it out. I'm familiar with all of Todd's works, from comic books to toys to budding baseball hero. So I was like, yeah, I'll check it out. He seems like a wild guy. And we're going to talk a little Todd McFarlane tonight. You guys go way deeper on the Todd McFarlane bench than I do. I guess when I got into comics, I learned Todd McFarlane was this comic guy. And he, you know, I learned the history retroactively. But like by the time I was into comics, McFarlane was already the toy guy. Like, because I was working at Toys R Us at the time. And, like, I had tangentially known he was a comic guy, but I didn't know what comics, how Spider-Man happened, how Image happened. I didn't know any of that. I just knew, oh, this guy's a comic guy, and now he makes starting lineups. Advanced, really detailed starting lineups.
Way to boil them down. Revolutionized. Blah, I can't talk tonight.
No, I like that. Revolutionized.
Revolutionized the dictionary. the action figure market. Action figures, you can distinctly see from before Todd and after Todd what action figures look like, how detailed they are, what the public would accept as something that's cool. It kind of created the like hardcore collector market as well, because people were always looking for McFarlane toys to put on their desk at work or on their bookshelf.
Yeah, I feel like personally his constant onness would get on my nerves. Like, I don't think I could be around Todd McFarlane for a lengthy period of time, but my man is a trailblazer. Like, whatever, I mean, the documentary is called, like, Hell I Won't, because that's kind of his motto. Like, when he gets his mind to something, he's going to fucking do it. And, you know, like, hell he won't, he's going to fucking do it.
Be it submit art to DC and Marvel Comics, or bang the door down of his, I think at the time, like 14-year-old, his wife when he was 17 or 18, and she was much younger. And like, hell he won't. He
I'm going to hit it. Like, hell I won't.
He definitely asked her out on several dates and eventually married her and has been in wedded bliss ever since. But that's something that
she eventually said yes out of total fear.
I could imagine that he was very persistent. So, yeah, I mean, but that's sort of Todd McFarlane's superpower. Whenever I first came to know a little bit more about Todd McFarlane, the legend of the rejection letters is what I always looked at. And to this day, I'm like, I'm a pussy. I couldn't send anything in to ever get rejected once, but he did it hundreds and he got rejected hundreds of times. Matt, was that something that you were aware of, Todd McFarlane's rejection letter legend?
Yeah. I had heard those stories, and it gave me hope. I sent one proposal once and I got rejected. That was the end of it. I guess it didn't give me enough hope.
Matt Cassell. Ah, hell.
Guess that'll do it.
It would be a much less interesting sci-fi documentary.
I would love the doc. All the you know, where they look at him and he's like out in the desert and shit. But it's the same thing, and it's Matt, and he's out in the desert and he's got his shades on, and there's one rejection letter, and he's like, oh well.
I love all the build up that leads to it. You know, we go through Matt's early like grade school art career and his inspirations and who he wanted to be like and like where his love of comics came from, and he's finally
his
like,
love letter to madness, which is that fucking drawing.
We're with him as he drafts this letter to send off with his artwork, and then it comes back negative, and he's like, came back negative, credits.
And it's not even like all that bad. It's just like, hey pal, try next year. And it's like, oh well. And he like lights his portfolio on fire.
That's the light beside him in the desert. It's the flames of failure playing across his face.
It's the flames across his face, and he's looking at, I guess I just didn't have it.
Not even failure, just like mediocrity.
We look down, the camera pans down to the fire, and it's his portfolio and his MacBook and his iMac and his iPad.
What I thought was interesting in the documentary was the way that it was sort of illustrated, where we got to see some of his earlier drawings, like cards he would make for his wife. And I was like, well, I mean, like, that looks good maybe for like a high school kid, but I feel like that's kind of along the lines of what our artwork looked like when we were high school kids. Mm-hmm. And something obviously like a switch went off for him where he was able to take it all to a whole new level But that was after he started sending his submissions to Marvel and DC and whoever else, what other Now Comics.
Was Continuity Comics up and running at that point? Neil Adams had a comic company?
I have no idea.
Okay.
But obviously, somewhere along the way, he just it all came together, and all of a sudden his stuff looked professional, whereas like before it was amateur hour. And I'm not sure exactly what happened. I mean, he seems like a very persistent individual, and I had heard what it wasn't on this documentary, but I had heard he would kind of, when he would learn how to draw, he would focus on one thing at a time until he really got good at it. So he was like, one week I would just draw hands for a week straight, just drawing hands after hands. And he got real good at that. And then he moved on to capes or something like that. So I never tried that approach. Maybe that's why I was never able to take it past a amateur kind of ability in high school.
There's a documentary, I think what you're referring to, it is The Image Revolution. I think that you're talking about a particular story as Rob Liefeld mocks Todd McFarlane in Todd McFarlane's very distinct voice, where he's talking about, in reference to how Liefeld and some of the other guys, they're just kind of starting out and they're just drawing the basics, where he has moved on and he is now drawing all of the advanced things because he's already mastered them because he spent so much time drawing just feet, just hands, just capes. I think that, and I think he mentions it in the documentary where he goes and he does his day jobs and he works and he comes home and he spends some time, or I think he works out, because at the time I think he was sort of still a semi-pro baseball player.
Yeah, he was a minor league player.
Yeah. And so he would do those kind of exercises and training regimen. And then at night he would sit down and he would put in 5-6 hours at the drawing table to be able to make himself professional level. And I've read something about, in the similar time frame, Jim Lee did something very similar where he gave himself, he had the luxury, I think, as well, where it was in between medical school and he was looking to maybe go back, and he gave himself a year to get to professional comics grade level. And he said that he looked at it as if he was an athlete. And he would wake up and he would train every day, and he would think, okay, well, if I was really a comics professional, what would I be doing? I'd probably be drawing for 8 hours a day. So I will draw for 8 hours a day as if I'm a professional at this right now. And in a year, I will be a professional. And that's how Jim Lee made himself into a professional. It seems like from Todd's story in this documentary, that's how he kind of put himself in this cauldron to mold himself into a professional as well. It's a lot. It's a lot to be able to just sit down and, after a long day at work, pound away at the drawing table like that.
One of the things that they don't get into in the documentary was about McFarlane's influences, because I'm not familiar with who his influences really are.
No.
Just when I look at the artwork, I'm like, who does that look like? It's kind of its own thing.
It has a lot of its own qualities, but there are two guys that I think, especially his early stuff.
Okay, I feel like you're going to say Frank Miller.
No. Neil Adams and Art Adams are the two, especially Art Adams. But Neil Adams, for the body structure and the way that he would craft muscles and figures,
okay,
that looks very Neil Adams. And if you look at faces, ears, yeah, noses, those are Art Adams. And a lot of the Image guys have a lot of that Art Adams stuff in it. If you listen to Rob Servations, Rob Liefeld's podcast, he admits that it influenced, Art Adams influenced him and some of the other guys. And if you look at, especially ears, noses, mouths, those really look like Art Adams in McFarlane style. And that'll do it, I guess. So any other takeaways from the documentary?
Like his desire to work and like go do school and then baseball and then like the paper route or whatever and then staying up till like 3 a.m. like doing art after that. I'm like, you're fucking nuts. Like I work my 8-hour job and like and by 4 p.m. I'm like, I'm good. I'm all set. Time to pour me a tequila and call it a day. Like I'll be ready. Like I'm like today I'm gonna log off and then I'm gonna start drawing something, and then like 4 o'clock rolls around and I think my entire professional career has been early. It's been seven to four since we graduated school, Ian. And like I think my brain is just conditioned. Like right around that time, like I just check out. So like it's so hard for me to shift into another gear and to get ready to be like, okay, well 4 o'clock, now we're doing this whole other thing for like another extended period of time. Like I just don't care to do it.
Yeah, I have a different thing that happens to me, and it's maybe because the work that I do is right-brained, so it's all Excel sheets and process and stuff that honestly bores the living shit out of me, but I know how to do it. And once 7 o'clock, 7:30 hits, that's when all the creative juices start flowing and I start getting ideas and I want to put pen to paper or pick up my stylus and start doing stuff. That's whenever I really feel creative, is later on in the evening. And there's a second part to that, is later on in the evening, that's when everybody stops texting, stops emailing, stops calling. You have this point in the evening where you're going to have uninterrupted creativity. So for me, that all makes sense. Yeah, late at night, everybody's asleep. Hell yeah. That's whenever I'm going to do my work.
That's how I feel in the morning. Like I'll get up Saturday and Sunday at like 7:30 and just...
But I always feel like there's a cap on that, because at some point everybody wakes up. But if you're doing it into the night, I mean, you honestly have until about 11 o'clock.
I don't have a problem with people interrupting me though. Like I can just go about my business and keep working. I don't have, no one's gonna be like, oh, you need to do this or you need to do this. Like weekends, like I go until I'm done going, which is normally around like 4 p.m.
Yeah.
But so, like I've always gotten up early, so like I love getting up early. I love getting up early. I'm never more productive than I am like before like 8 o'clock.
I can never flip the creative switch on. I could do something like put some flat colors down or maybe like do some thumbnails, maybe, but I couldn't do real creative work in the morning ever. Matt, what's your flow?
I don't know. Whenever. whenever it hits me. But one of the things that I thought was interesting in the documentary, the McFarlane documentary, was how he felt like he needed to create 4 pillars to build this empire on top of. And he says it as if like it was necessary to do it this way, but I couldn't help but think, but 2 of those pillars never really became anything. And the 4 pillars are comics. Okay, you got that. Toys. Okay, you got that. Video games. Not really. Like you did what? 1, and then Spawn appeared as a character in like Soul Calibur or something.
And still, Spawn, wasn't he featured in Mortal Kombat this year or something like that? I know he has made an appearance.
He was in Soul Calibur.
I mean, recent, like,
was
as
he
in
Mortal
this year.
Kombat? Okay, so yeah. So he was a character.
But I mean, yeah, like I'm,
that
I'm
doesn't sound like
you.
A pillar
just,
to build your business. Yeah. And then what was the other one? Film and TV.
Yeah.
And he had a small amount of success in the late 90s. With Spawn, with a live action movie and 3 seasons on HBO, which seems to be looked back very favorably today. Like, I'd like it to seems check to that have out. Aged
I
well.
Would, I would too. Maybe we ought to do a couple commentary eps.
I'm a dive into hell.
Are those half those are half hour eps,
yeah.
Right?
I would hope
and
so.
And he I can remember it was so melodramatic at the beginning of each episode, which I don't think they include now, like if you buy it on DVD or whatever. But when it was on HBO, when it aired, and it aired like late night, it was like at 10 o'clock or something.
Right before beat off hour with Real Sex.
Fuck yeah.
Right, it was the appetizer.
What? So I could get down to business.
But Todd McFarlane would introduce each episode, and I can remember you would see like close-ups of him drawing, you know, like you'd see the pen and ink, and he'd be drawing, and then he'd turn around, he's sitting at his drawing desk, and he would have this like kind of melodramatic monologue real quick. Do you remember that?
It was very much like Rod Serling from The Twilight Zone. That's how yes. what I
yes.
felt like
yes.
all the time.
You're he exactly
was like,
right.
He was like the Crypt Keeper. He was the Todd Keeper.
The Todd. Imagine a world. Yeah, he was definitely the... That's what I always thought of. I was like, oh, that's what you're doing.
So, I don't know how successful he was at two of the four endeavors that he set forth with, although... Two of the things that he decided to do, he became the best at. Literally the best in the business, for a while at least. Mm-hmm. I don't know if McFarlane toys are still considered the best action figures. I know that NECA, N-E-C-C-A, makes some really very true-to-life toys where they even give the sculptors credit on the packaging, which is pretty cool. I feel like their likenesses have proven to be maybe a little more real than current McFarlane toys. I feel like McFarlane toys peaked a while ago, and then they've regressed in terms of their overall quality. The paint jobs on them, the overall sculpts, that kind of thing.
I don't follow the toy game close enough to know.
Well, I mean, I don't buy the stuff, but I see it at the shops and shit when you go.
And I watch toy reviews and things like that. I haven't seen a McFarlane review of a toy in a very long time. I can't think of something that has come out McFarlane toys that.
Speaking of toys that look good, Brian brought over the open versions of those Masters of the Universe Origins, He-Man, Battle Cat, and Skeletor.
Did you guys play with them?
We did.
Did you? Pow,
they
pow.
They look really fucking cool. Like. Yeah.
No,
person,
I get to be He-Man. No, I get to be He-Man.
In person, they look great. Like, He-Man's hair color is, it's a little, it has this, like, weird, almost, like, translucent quality to it. That sucks. But everything else, like, it looks so good. Like, the body.
He has Hulk Hogan hair,
colors.
You're saying?
Yeah, like, they look so much better in person. And, like, they feel good. They have a weight to them. Like, they're cool toys, I think. I feel like watching reviews of them and just seeing them in the box, it doesn't really do them justice, actually having one in your hand and being able to fuck around with it a little bit.
Yeah. I to that point, it seems like, is that Hasbro that's doing that stuff now, or was that Mattel?
Mattel doing those.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of any other toy manufacturers outside of the ones that we mentioned. Super 7 does retro stuff, but it's not really innovating or doing anything wildly different.
DC Direct was making some pretty great toys, although McFarlane is now, his company is creating some DC Direct figures from like the multiverse.
No, DC Direct is gone now.
McFarlane does have the rights to create DC figures. At least this year.
Yeah. Like when did DC Direct go away? Because I
about
still
a year ago.
Oh, okay.
But either way, the stamp that McFarlane's toy company put on action figures is forever, like forever, changed the way that people look at action figures and sculpt action figures and the Four Horsemen, the sculptors. That the fact that I know who the Four Horsemen are, they are sculptors that changed the way that we look at these toys, and they went on to work with Mattel to do the He-Man figures in the early 2000s. That definitely changed a lot of things around in the way that we look at toys.
Ian, what was your favorite McFarlane toy? Like, that is kind of a unique creation, not a Spawn character, not the Kiss things, but something more unique that was created specifically for the toy line.
You're putting me on the spot because
Wait,
I did
something
have
something that was created just for the toy line.
Just for
toy line? Just the
or
Spawn
just
toy line?
No, just like the McFarlane toys.
Oh, I think I see where you're trying to lead me. So I'm a big. I think this is where you're trying to.
I'm not trying to lead you anywhere.
You're not trying to get me going. Okay. No. Well, I love all the NFL properties that McFarlane has, and back in the mid-2000s, whenever the Steelers were winning Super Bowls and were really great, they had a whole rush of Steelers, classic Steelers, current Steelers. I own a Rashard Mendenhall action figure. I think I own all of the Steelers action
really
figure.
Good.
He was supposed to be really good. I think I own all of them. I also have a Heinz Ward variant Gotham Rogues from the Dark Knight movie. So I think that that's probably what I like the most.
Okay, but that's kind of, maybe I wasn't clear. It can't be like an existing property
thing,
or something.
Okay.
It's got to be something that was specifically created, like a creation specifically as this toy.
I'm going to have to think about that. You sound like you have something.
I don't know if
I
do. I
don't understand the question, like, because like I think of all the like all the cool stuff they did, but it's all part of some line. Like you're saying, like the way I'm reading your question is, what toy did he create just to make it as a toy? But
right.
Everything I think of, it's like, oh, well, that's the Kiss line, that's Sleepy Hollow, that's Spawn, that's starting lineup. You know, like.
Okay. Well, he did the Twisted Land of Oz figures. Hmm. He did.
Okay.
He did.
I see what you're talking about.
He did like the remember the motorcycle line of I think they were like Spawn motorcycle things, but they were specifically created as a toy line. Like they didn't exist in the comics or anything. That might be my favorite, the motorcycle ones, just because it was a little different, because it would be a character that came with the bike, but the bike itself was the real like interesting focal point. He did a line of like dragons. He may have done Conan toys, and I realize that is something that exists, but it was like the McFarlane kind of treatment to Conan. He did, like, I believe he did a line of military characters. So he would do, like, a Navy SEAL and a Green Beret, all that shit.
I vaguely remember this Twisted Fairy Tales.
Twisted Fairy Tales, yeah, that was another
like
one.
This
really cool shit.
This Dorothy with the Munchkins is, it's making, it's real weird. It's very strange.
The Twisted stuff was right up my alley because it was scary and sexy.
Yeah, this is very scary.
Like,
kind of sexy.
I'm afraid to put my dick in it, but I'm going to put my dick in it.
Yeah, it's. I do remember this stuff vaguely.
If this counts based on the framing of my question.
It was a very narrow question, Matt. I will have to say that.
Well, I think I listed a number of options here that fall into it. Do the monster play sets qualify?
I don't know what those are.
Yeah, I don't really remember
like
those.
Monster play sets, like Universal monster play sets?
Yeah, they were basically Universal monsters, but again, given the McFarlane treatment. So the play sets
probably,
were,
because, they're a property, but they're not from a specific movie. It's not Bela Lugosi Dracula.
Right. It's
McFarlane's version of Dracula.
Yeah. Now, what I thought was so fucking cool about these things was they didn't follow the same kind of format as all the other figures up to this point. He had done Spawn. He had done Kiss. He had done starting lineups. I forget what that was, McFarlane Sports. I don't know what it was called. But he did all these, and they were all essentially the same scale. They were all essentially, outside of those initial Spawn figures, they were much more statue-like, you know, with like bizarre points of articulation that didn't make sense to move in any other position except for the one that it like came in the box
except
as.
For the like the action pose that they wanted you to put it in.
Right. It was like, why do you even put articulation on it? Mm-hmm. Like, there's no point. But these things, these monster play sets, the focus was much more on the play set itself. They would each come with two like little figurines that had more articulation in them than a standard, I would say, McFarlane toy. But the detail on like the environment and all that stuff was so cool. The first, I think there were like two series and each one had four different play sets. And the first one that I got was the Hunchback of Notre Dame. And it came with the Hunchback, obviously. And then the other one was like some kind of executioner that had this big axe. But the Hunchback was so awesome looking because he was so deformed. Loved it. So if that qualifies, that would be my pick. But the motorcycles were cool.
The more we talk about these McFarlane figures, what I really remember the most is how fucking heavy they were and how that always kind of rip off the peg at Toys R Us because the card back couldn't support how fucking heavy a lot of that big plastic was.
I remember there were plastic tabs that you could put on the back of them.
Right.
To sort of reinforce it.
And then it would bust through those as well.
So then you would have to go and put tab over tab and staple them so that the goddamn McFarlane toys would hold up.
They were
up.
So fucking big and heavy. So
yeah,
much dense plastic.
This was the heyday that you and I worked at Toys R Us whenever these things were all over, filthy on the shelves. It makes me wonder, without all the shelf space, It's got to be affecting McFarlane toys more so than any of these other toy makers because it's such a niche product in such a very distinct market that they're trying to hit. It's got to be really hurting his business.
I don't know. I would assume it can't be hurting his any more than anyone else. Like, McFarlane should be shifting into the collector's market like Mattel and Takara and all these other companies are doing.
I guess so, but
really like focus on what's in the stores. And
but he's coming from a previous place of being in the stores and selling to those bigger venues.
You don't think he's capable of shifting gears?
He's capable of anything, Paul. I watched the documentary.
Except for creating video games, apparently.
Except for being a professional baseball player.
Right. But Matt, to your point, 2 out of 4 ain't bad. He hit 50% Empire, I think, that McFarlane is at right now. So I guess we talked a lot about the toys. I don't feel like we really talked a ton about just his art and his comics. His Spider-Man comic, I think, is currently probably the third biggest selling comic of all time. I think that Spawn might be, or at least it debuted as the biggest selling indie comic at the time. I don't know if that still holds up or that counts anymore.
I'm sure it does. I mean, what the hell could have possibly outsold Spawn number one in the indie world? Nothing.
Nothing. I mean, I'm thinking maybe like did Wildcats jump it or something like that? But
so.
I don't think so either.
No.
Well, so, would Walking Dead count? Or since it's Image and Image isn't really independent?
No, it Image is still considered an indie comic, but this is where we start talking about what comics were like and what comics are now, and it is worlds different. The Walking Dead, no matter how many issues The Walking Dead could sell at the time that it came out, it could never eclipse what was happening in the early 90s. Because people were just buying. I own two or three issues of Spawn number one. I know, Matt, you do as well.
I think I only have one copy.
You only
of
have
it.
One? You don't have two?
I don't think so. No. I think I just have one.
I mean,
I have two copies of Savage Dragon number one. I have the newsstand version and the comic store version.
You know what I didn't get whenever it first came? I didn't get Youngblood number one. I have a second printing of Youngblood number one. It has like the gold
around it. I got it after the fact. Same with Spawn. I think I got Spawn for Christmas.
Really?
One year. Yeah.
Dude, I can remember exactly where I was in the Phantom of the Attic the day that I bought, because I had been looking for Spawn number. We talk about this all the time. It wasn't on your radar that
Image
this thing had happened.
Right.
And to me, it was all I could think about for probably 3 months, upwards of 6 months, because all of a sudden, all of the guys were gone. And I was seeing these advertisements in Marvel Comics, like, hey, Spawn by Todd McFarlane. That just like pen and ink drawing with the pen and ink font that he did. And that was like the only advertising piece that was really out there for a long, long time. And when it was finally on the newsstands, man, I definitely scooped up too. And I was really, really into Spawn because I was waiting for it.
Yeah.
Every time I hear Youngblood, I have to look him up because I picture Shatterstar. And I know they're different characters, but I always have to look it up to make sure that they are. I am thinking of who I'm supposed to be thinking of.
I love that you referred to the main character as Youngblood.
Oh, that's not Youngblood?
Youngblood is a team book.
Who's the main guy in Youngblood?
Shaft.
The guy with the bow and arrow and the big hair on the top.
Yes.
Mm.
Youngblood.
Gotcha. Well, that's why I have to look it up. Because
who is Youngblood? And it pulls up the hockey movie.
Oh, that's what came up first. Until I typed comics. And then I got Youngblood, the book. And I'm like, oh, well, there's this guy that I'm thinking of right in front. He should be Youngblood.
He should be Youngblood.
He's not.
Much like the guy with the visor is X-Men. So, yeah, man. I couldn't wait for whenever the Image revolution happened and these guys were putting out their books that were, in all fairness, just a, you know, they look very similar to the Marvel heroes. Spawn looked kind of similar to Spider-Man, and I was into that. And Youngblood looked like X-Force, and Wildcats looked like X-Men, but it was with the guarantee that there was going to be more mature themes, and it was going to be a new 90s take and more serious and blood and tits and all that. And I was there for it, man. Like,
oh shit,
I loved it. I two of my favorite things.
Blood and tits. Can't get enough
bloody
tits. Oh, look out.
And they delivered. There were blood and there were tits, and it was the 90s,
except in the blood tit book, because that's the team. Oh, that's, man, not the character.
Good thing it wasn't called Young Tits.
Hey, I have a couple issues of that. Speaking of Young Tits,
I'm pretty sure that I got Blood Tits number 0 with the bloody bra.
I wish I could
die cut foil embossed bra.
And when you open the cover with the bra, the titties are underneath it.
Bloody.
Right. Well, no fucking shit.
Return it. It has the same chemical reaction as Zartan's face, where you have to put your hand on it and then the blood appears. Same technology.
Oh, boy.
That's a callback to last week, folks.
So, what are we to expect out of McFarlane, since he felt like he had a necessary four-pillar empire kind of construction scheme, and I think we've determined that two of the four pillars are unsound. Is he going to ever fulfill those aspirations? Is he going to have a line of video games?
I feel like...
Is he going to have a more steady stream of media, like movies?
I feel like the movie TV pillar could be very sound, because I think Spawn is a very viable character. I think the story is, you know, sort of timeless. Like, I think it can really work if he'd just get the fuck out of the way.
Like, oh, he's the problem.
If he would, well, it sounds like he wants complete control over this. And, like, if, I don't know. Like, I know he wasn't really happy with, you know, aspects of the cartoon and the
movie. I don't
think
Marvel,
like,
the MCU, is beating his door down and saying, like, hey, Todd, can we make a Spawn movie? If you would just get out of the way and let us make it. I don't think that's happening. Nobody is trying to do it.
Are you sure? Are you sure people haven't approached him and been like, hey, this is what we want to do? And he's like, nah, I don't want to do that. Well, and then he closes the door on them.
Yeah, because that is the whole point of this documentary.
Do Spawn like he doesn't want to do
it. The whole reason why he left Marvel was so that he never had to work with Marvel or anybody that would take his creation and do something with it that he didn't give full approval on. So
although he loves the idea of having Spawn as a character live on beyond him, like one day he's going to be dead and somebody else will be writing Spawn comic books.
I think for him, for that to happen, you need to have people while you're living write that character. There have to be different takes. And I think that's a problem with Spawn. That's a problem with Savage Dragon. All the Image stuff is that there aren't different reinventions or reinterpretations of these characters. That's what's great about all the Marvel and DC stuff, is that you get to see these different sides and different facets of the character.
I think it's funny that you're basing this argument on, when death comes, Todd isn't going to say, like, hell I will. And
oh, I can't wait till he fights
live
the Grim
forever.
Reaper.
When he fights Spawn himself, when he shows up at his door, says, like hell I will, and lives forever. Does Spawn not have different creators and different versions? Has it not really had, like, different takes? Like, I know other writers have written it, but has he been real, like, hardcore about, this is what you need to do, you can't deviate from this path? Because that's, like, I mean, for is as what's the op what oh I can't think of
I don't know what
more.
You're trying to say
for so. Is for as trailblazing as he has been, wanting to take things to the next level, do different things constantly, like being in the public eye, having success, like, this seems to be a real roadblock that he's not willing to let Spawn evolve into the next thing that it needs to be to stay a property that is craved by you know, comics public and the general public in different incarnations.
Maybe it's sort of the, I want to be the person to always helm this book, and it needs to always be something that I've written, and I have my baked in fan base that isn't growing but isn't moving, so I'm just playing to that fan base.
Well, yeah, but isn't there room for, like, Ultimate Spawn? Like, Spawn the New 52? Like, here's, like, because I know there were a bunch of Spawn figures that was, like, Medieval Spawn and, like, Space Spawn, and here's Underwater Deep Diving Spawn. Like,
well, Medieval Spawn is part of, like, you see Medieval Spawn in the first 12 issues, so in the first year you get to see that.
But I don't know, I don't have any real frame of reference, because I've never created a character like Spawn that's had such a huge impact. So I don't know how I would be willing to let someone just take the reins and, like, do whatever and fuck around with it. But it seems like the way all of these other comic book characters have endured for some like, you know, centuries. Like, he needs to, like, loosen the reins.
What comic book character has endured for centuries?
The Yellow Kid.
Oh, I guess not centuries. I guess we haven't had... I was thinking the 1,000 issues, not 100 years for Superman and Batman.
Okay.
So that's my bad.
Time out. What a fucking save. Holy shit.
That wasn't me covering my ass.
That was a gold star.
That was
dude.
Exactly.
No hesitation.
Because it was exactly what it was. It was exactly what it was. So yeah, like these characters have been around for decades, and like maybe that's what Spawn needs to just Todd just let someone else do Ultimate Spawn. Like let Spawn use a cell phone because he wasn't in 93.
I guess there's a couple competing ideas about that. And I don't love where it lands me when I think about this because it makes me realize that maybe the image characters of the 90s weren't very good. So Cyberforce, Mark Silvestri, has had a bunch of different writers, a bunch of different reboots, a bunch of different artists to try to re-envision, reinvigorate, and reimagine that world. Wildcats also has had many different versions, different writers, different versions of the Wildcats that have come along.
I think those properties stink, though. I think at their core, they're not all that good.
Well, that's what I'm getting at, is that that's not good either whenever these characters are taken by some different creators and changed and decades later have different versions, and they're not very good either. And Spawn and Savage Dragon are the polar opposite of that, where it's had the same writer the entire time and it's petered out.
They've never renumbered either, and renumbering is a way to spike sales, but ultimately it doesn't have any lasting effects. So I'm glad that they've never renumbered. They don't do the Hellboy volume stuff in an effort to constantly, in a more respectful way, continually have new number ones.
Mm-hmm. I don't mind a volume because it's sort of like this is a mini series.
I suppose, like, but these books are ongoing. They're mm-hmm. ongoing series, and I respect very much that they have maintained the same numbering, much like their predecessors did up until semi-recently, mm-hmm. in a more modern time. Here's the thing. McFarlane has been involved in the story of Spawn in the comics, like, the whole time. Yeah. He's never not been involved. To varying degrees, he had other guys help him with the story, other guys maybe doing the scripting. Certainly, he stepped back in an artistic capacity, but that's the thing. That's what would reinvigorate the character. People, like, Todd McFarlane is a bigger deal than Spawn is. And that's kind of, I think, the thing that people fail to recognize about Spawn. McFarlane is the reason, not Spawn. If McFarlane went and created a whole new comic book character and he was drawing it, it would sell so many copies. Or if he just came back to Spawn as the regular artist, let's say he said, you know what, because he encouraged me very much in the documentary when he said, when I get toward the end of my career, all I want to do is just go back and draw. That's really all I want to do. I want to draw comics. And I'm like, can you do that now? Like, why do we have to wait mm-hmm. until you're winding down? Like, just do it. You have such an incredible gift. Better than so many other of your peers and contemporaries. If he would just come back and draw the book, it would immediately go to the top of the charts. And it would reignite interest. It would get all kinds of interest to probably propel it forward in a much stronger way for movies or even video games, if that's the direction you wanted to go. It might even spike interest in the toys, because that's why people like him. Yeah, they liked his toys, but they primarily like him as a comic book artist. They don't give a shit about McFarlane as a writer. Nobody cares about his stories. I think it's kind of a cool concept, but nobody has ever read it and been like, that is just the fucking most profound bit of comic book writing I've ever read never happened. You know what I mean, Paul?
I do.
I definitely think that there are two ways to go to reinvigorate Spawn as a property. One would be McFarlane needs to step away completely and just hand it over to a new creative team completely, wholesale. And I think no renumbering needed. Just do it at issue number, 421. Who gives a shit? But just do it.
That's a long way off. They just did 300 this past year.
I'm saying, I'm thinking into the future.
Okay.
I don't want to be rash with this. I don't want to just make quick changes here, Matt.
Wait, that's like 120 issues from now. That's centuries from now, I think.
I believe so. According to Paul,
Be 1,000 issues
Paul
from now.
Histrionics.
They're interchangeable. I don't know if you guys have seen a fucking dictionary lately.
I revolutionized the dictionary earlier today.
He revolutionized.
Yes, I can't even say my fucked up word again. The second change would be to just have another writer on there and have McFarlane do the pencils. Now, that would be an impossible task that I'm asking this writer to do, because you can't ask Todd McFarlane to acquiesce on his own character.
Well, why couldn't it just be he just takes over all the creative responsibility on the book? He starts writing it himself, maybe no aid or whatever, but then he starts drawing it. Wouldn't that be enough? I feel like it would be enough.
It could be. I think to get true lasting... A true lasting effect to make this character either stand or fall on its own, you would need to have McFarlane step away. And that is what would make it be is this a quality character is this not?
You align with Paul. You think McFarlane is in the way. He is a roadblock. To the success of Spawn.
To the maybe everlasting iconic nature.
It just sounds weird to me that like, everything I've read about this potential Spawn movie, it's like, he's doing it, he's got to be involved, he's directing it. And I'm like, Todd, baby, like, maybe let a director direct it?
Remember the last time a comic book guy directed a movie?
It's called The Spirit?
The Spirit. I didn't see it, but I saw the trailers, and I feel like that's enough to...
It looked like Sin City Part 2. The trailers didn't look...
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I saw The Spirit. It was a mess, but it has some... sexy stuff in it, man.
You piece.
Holy smokes. Hey, man, I know what I like.
You and Frank Miller. Frank Miller knows what you like.
He must. I do like all that Sin City stuff. I don't like Frank Miller's current insanity, but I do like the way that he lights a scene. We'll say that.
Man, I'll tell you what, that Sin City movie, I haven't seen it in a while, but I really want to go back and revisit it.
I went to the theaters to see both
Me
Sin
too.
City movies. Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I thought the second one was fine. It was okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Did he do that one totally himself?
I don't remember.
Okay. Anyway, I'm sorry. Been. Paul, this isn't the Frank Miller sci-fi documentary podcast.
Hey, when is this podcast ever this podcast and we stay on what this is?
Never.
Never.
Maybe never, from what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I think maybe Todd needs to just loosen the reins, step out of the way a little. I'd say give him like executive producer, creative control of whatever the project is, but I feel like that would also give him too much of the reins to be like, no, don't do that. You change this, change this, change this. Like, just let it go, man.
How much creative control did Kirkman have on The Walking Dead?
Because
he seemed to love everything that they did on that show.
Yeah, well, I'm sure he did. He was getting paid like a motherfucker.
Was he?
But he oh, had... Yeah. He was an executive producer. He had writing credits. Yeah, that show was so fucking big. He was just fucking cashing checks.
Still is. We're not watching, right, but he still is.
But he had executive producer credits, but I think...
Oh, that's right. They haven't ended it yet.
No,
No end in sight, Matt.
But he wasn't the showrunner. He didn't have final say on stuff. Like, he was willing to let storylines change and offer ideas and really let the showrunners of each season dictate what was going to happen. But, like, Todd McFarlane just doesn't seem to have that personality of, like, yeah, so what? So long as it's a success, I'm fine if you guys want to do this. He seems, like, very hardcore and very rigid and very my way or the highway.
Yeah, you might be right. I didn't actually gather that much watching the documentary. I thought he seemed, like, relatively kind of down to earth for being kind of a revolutionary talent that he is.
I thought that too. He seemed pretty chill at times, and like all the people that work with him certainly aren't going to be like, this guy's a fucking piece of shit. Certainly they're not going to say that, but they all seemed genuine. And even like, I don't know, maybe this documentary really painted him in a good light, but through all of the other news I've ever heard, and, you know, interviews and stuff that I've heard through my love of comic books, it's like Todd's way or the highway. And I respect that. He's built this McFarlane empire on that. But, like, I think right now, maybe you don't need to direct Spawn. Let professionals do it. I don't know. I think he may be in the way of, he may be getting in the way of himself. But I don't know the intricacies of his life or his properties.
I was thinking he's doing it because nobody else is stepping up to do it. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess he's going to do it himself because nobody else wants to.
Maybe not. And you make a good point about how Marvel's all up in their business right now. And like, no one is clamoring to make the Spawn movie. But it seems like such a neat property with some cachet to it that people would love to make. And like,
right.
And I don't know. My sense is like people are coming to him like, hey, here's this pitch. And he's like, no.
And also being the biggest black superhero of all time, why doesn't Ryan Coogler make this movie?
Can we still say that? Like,
well, Black Panther, I guess, is the biggest one now. I would say so. But, I mean, okay, up until two years ago.
Yeah, for 20-plus years, he was...
And it was strictly so. On the power, really, of the comic and maybe the animated series, because I don't think that the film really made a dent in terms of his overall popularity. It's the comic book. The strength of the character is from the popularity of the comic and the creator. But... It seems like they are kind of matching up race with the race of the character in terms of like the film creator and the character. Coogler seems like he'd probably be a pretty good candidate for it. You know, obviously he has some superhero chops under his belt. And, you know, I was even thinking about Black Panther this weekend, obviously.
Oh, why?
Something
happened?
And well, I was thinking about it even before the passing of Chadwick Boseman. And I was thinking, like, I was really kind of hard on that movie because I mean, I remember some of the flaws that I kind of attributed to it, but I really got to give it credit that it majorly steps out of the Marvel formula, like, big time compared to what so many of the other movies kind of feel like they're following the same template. And this movie did world building unlike anything we had really ever seen in a Marvel movie. And it was doing some really unique things that made it stand on its own. And it wasn't what I consider to be like a comedy disguised as an action movie. It was just a fucking comic book movie. And I really like, I swear to God, before all this bullshit went down this weekend, I was like, man, I really need to revisit that.
Well, we were just talking about it last week, so maybe that stirred something in you.
Yeah.
You touched on the world building, and I think that, and I think we've talked about this before, but, you know, no disrespect to Chadwick Boseman, but Black Panther was the least interesting thing about that entire movie. everything, the world of Wakanda, the political dynamics.
Right, the traditions.
The tradition, the different tribes, Killmonger as a character, all that stuff was really, really engrossing and something that I was really interested in outside of just like, oh, it's Black Panther and he has superpowers, all that other stuff. I'd love to go back to Wakanda just to see the tribes and that whole interaction and the tradition. So I think that we'll be now forced to go in that direction if they make a Black Panther 2. I don't know if they can. I mean, I guess.
I don't think they'll recast. I think they will simply. It's already built. Like, yeah. There's an out built into the story.
Yeah,
where
his sister becomes Black Panther.
Exactly. Yeah. Or somebody else, whether it's a sister or whatever.
Winter Soldier becomes Black Panther.
Yeah, whatever. Whatever.
Hey, it's 2020. Just tear it all. Burn it all down.
Hey, diversity.
You know what?
In 2020,
right.
A white guy can be Black Panther.
A Black Panther.
Paul, before we sign off, was there anything in the documentary, you not being kind of as schooled on McFarlane as Ian and I, was there anything that really kind of stood out to you that you were surprised by?
I guess just his... It was such a quick documentary. It was only 45 minutes, so it really just like had to hit all the big points, and like you couldn't really get super deep into anything. But I was surprised at how kind of chill he seems. Like I think he is always on most of the time, especially when he has a specific project in mind or he's working on something. I think he's probably completely relentless and like really hard to work with. I'd love to have a beer with his coworkers that were in that documentary and be like, okay, what's Todd really like? Because I think we really got a glossed over, make Todd look good in this 45 minutes documentary. So I don't think this was, you know, the in-depth journalistic piece that really gave me any more insight, but like,
yeah, it was kind of a puff piece, wasn't it?
Yeah. But after this, I kind of think if I could sit down and have a couple beers with him and he could just shut off for a minute and, you know, just talk about, you know, comics and baseball and, you know, whatever, and just like hang out. Like, he doesn't seem like that version, like the version that like his family probably gets is way different than the one that media normally portrays. And like, as much as this was kind of a puff piece, like that went a long way for me to be like, oh, this guy, I think some more of his dimension came out, even if it wasn't necessarily supposed to.
Matt, do you have any Todd McFarlane media that you would recommend to listeners at home to check out based on your extensive career with Mr. McFarlane?
Yeah, definitely check out the animated series that was on HBO. I think it holds up pretty well. It was somewhat revolutionary for the quality of the animation, being an American show. At that time, that level of animation didn't come out of America. It pretty much all would come out of Japan. So definitely check that out. And then, of course, the Iced Earth album, The Dark Saga, is something worth checking out. If you're into the story of Spawn, especially the earlier issues, definitely give that album a listen. And have the liner notes with you, and you can kind of read along, because it is pretty cool stuff. And it does kind of fit like a heavy metal style, I think. Like, heavy metal is the right soundtrack, I think, for this subject matter.
Yeah, it's very much in the style of what McFarlane's proclivities, what he was really interested in. When you think of Spawn, you think of heavy metal. When you look at the things that interest Todd McFarlane, it's demons and hell. And I have two recommendations, are both art based. One is Todd's art book.
Oh, that's so good.
It's a coffee table book. I collect artists' illustration books. This one's called The Devil's in the Details.
You have so many, Ian. You need to start collecting coffee tables.
I really do. I have a few.
So silly.
The Devil's in the Details has a bunch of his early artwork that we were talking about, so you can see the progression. It has all of those letters from Marvel and DC rejecting him and telling him he's not good enough. Those are all in there. It has a lot of Todd's early characters, early renditions of Spawn, whenever it was more of a sci-fi character. A lot of stuff that I love, which is process like pen and ink work on Marvel's stock board, where you can see where he did all of his illustrations. And one thing that I always liked about Todd McFarlane, back in the day, you would have two different versions of a cover. You would have a newsstand version, which would have a barcode, and you would have a direct market version, which would have that barcode area just empty. Sometimes Marvel would put a stock photo of Spider-Man or Captain America or the Fantastic Four or whatever, but Todd McFarlane would use that space to put little sort of like extra illustrations and little Easter eggs in there, a little, you know, quickly inked out sketch of Venom, or maybe some, you know, or maybe Spider-Man burning in flames because this issue was about Inferno. All that stuff was really good. So my first recommendation, The Devil's in the Details, is his coffee table book. And then the second recommendation I would have is Spider-Man, the just not amazing, not spectacular, not the web of Spider-Man, number 6 and 7. It's the issues that feature Hobgoblin and Ghost Rider. And the Hobgoblin in this version of McFarlane's universe, or the Marvel universe, for the longest time Hobgoblin had a mask and he was just a dude, but this version of Hobgoblin wore a mask, but under the mask he looked like a Hobgoblin, had a real sort of religious zealot bend to him, to the character. He was scarring people and killing people as a sacrifice. Really weird religious demonic stuff. It really sort of highlighted what McFarlane would go on to do with Spawn, and he just did it in the pages of Spider-Man. Great art, but really sort of haunting stuff. And it is a precursor of, hey, Marvel's giving me their biggest character to do whatever I want with it, to write it. I'm gonna do some really weird stuff. So Spider-Man number 7, 6, and 7. Really great stuff. So check that out.
I think that's going to do it for us tonight. Thank you, McSauce listeners, for coming on this McFarlane 90s comics journey with us tonight. McSauce-lin. My name is Paul McGinty.
Ian Sharpley.
Matt Cassell.
We'll see you next time.